Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 31, Simple Steps to Physical Security. Here we go. Co-hosting again with me today is Doug Carson. How you doing, Doug?
Hey, Rick. I'm great. Thanks. Yourself?
I'm great. Hey, thanks for carving the time. I know you're a busy dude. And if we're talking about security and we're, you know, focused on virtualization, we're not going to go too far from this guy, Mr. Ed Haletke. Ed, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Rick? How are you doing, Doug?
Great, thanks.
Good, good.
Thank you for having me on again.
Hey, not a problem. I wouldn't know who else to call with the topic at hand, so that's why I reached out to you. So basically, you know, my thought here, guys, I frequently go on the path of looking at in-the-box security and, you know, be it network security and the security in my own little world, okay? Edward has his own standard of security, but I wanted to focus on physical security. And basically, I started thinking about locking the rack. And before we were talking, Edward was saying, well, that might not even be that good of a thing. Edward was pointing to things outside of the rack, like the door and the camera. So my question to get us started, Edward, is what kind of like generic big picture physical security approach would you offer, you know, for the medium or small data center if they don't have any physical security measures in place?
Actually, making sure you have someone monitoring whoever's coming in the door. In other words, a person at the front desk is always the first level of defense, mm-hmm. to make sure that that person is the right person to be there. A lot of small businesses, their data center is possibly in a closet somewhere that may or may not lock. And even if it does lock, it probably has the cheapest lock known to man. Mm-hmm. Or it could be in a real data center somewhere in a hosting provider, and they take care of all the security. Or it could be a small half rack sitting in an office somewhere.
For the small half rack type of thing, or at least the unconventional data center, let's just call it that, you know, those are the toughest, right? Because it doesn't always make sense to have, you know, access card with camera and, you know, visitor logs and maybe escorting people through, that type of stuff, if there's any people in the area. But, you know, when it comes to, like, the half racks that are in a remote location or something like that, I think people just kind of gravitate towards the lock that's built into the half rack, but those are generic locks, like we all know. I found this website, actually. It's funny we say that. There is this website. It's called, like, officefurniturelocks.com. And literally, I don't remember what it is, but you put in the number on your, like, office furniture and say that it's a Hayworth or something, and boom, they'll send you a key for $5. You know, and then you can get into anything.
That's not uncommon. Matter of fact, I know quite a few people that have those keys.
Yeah, and
that's what they do. That's what they do for a living, is break into companies, and they get paid to do it. But the main thing is that for these small businesses, a camera, always, an infrared camera you can get for $20. Use it, plug it in, have it record.
What do you mean by infrared?
Actually, I have one here. I actually have a small ball camera that's an infrared camera. It sees in the dark.
Sees in the dark, got it. So the lights don't have to be on for the camera to be effective.
Well, you need some light, but ambient light is usually sufficient, or it measures heat. So the main thing is that those types of cameras you can buy at Home Depot, or actually I got mine on the internet at one of my companies I deal with all the time for X10 material. But you can also get them at I saw them at Best Buy.
Yeah, they're really popular, and I bought a kit for my home, from Smart Home.
Exactly. You can do something simple like that and have it record, but it's cabled, so it's not going to turn off because of wireless. It's going to get power from somewhere. Put it on a small battery and have it record to a 9-hour or 10-hour VCR. Those aren't cheap. I mean, they're like $200-$400 for that. They record to disk sometimes. They record to tape for sometimes. It depends on what model you get. If you have it recording to disk, you can on a computer, for example, you could actually have it record to a remote location, somebody's house.
In fact, that's what I did in my home situation. Recently, I had a home for sale, but I wasn't living in it, so it was wireless. But I didn't really like the wireless, but given the time constraints and the cost constraints I had, it was the right thing to do. And I had it actually record to my house that I'm living in now. And it was a great sense of comfort. And I had it replay. I think I took a frame every like 10 seconds or something like that. I kept a month's worth of data. So that was me being ridiculous, but...
Actually, it's not all that ridiculous. A lot of people use these to monitor secondary homes. They monitor, I mean, like, for example, I have one that I use purely to monitor the front of my house. So, because I always telecommute, I'm in the back.
Right.
I can't hear anything. So I'm always monitoring where trucks will arrive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have it up right now because I'm waiting for a delivery.
Right.
If you're a small business and you have a loading dock or a room that's on the back side that has other doors, putting one of these cameras on the front outside is not a bad idea because these are access points.
Right, and that gives you visibility into who's coming in, presumably 24 hours a day.
Exactly.
And, you know, we've all had some sort of story. I've got a story. I don't know if I should share it, but I will. At a previous role I had where in the data center, we had a new piece of equipment, brand new piece of equipment. I won't even say what type it was, but it was expensive, and it was something that we were scheduled to install. Well, the cleaning staff threw it away into the crusher that night.
Ooh.
Brand new. Like, it was heavy, so they had to call for help to lift it up, to put it on the cart, to throw it into the crusher. And we didn't know that that was the case until we replayed the video. We thought it was stolen, okay, because it was gone, right? New piece of equipment, gone, makes sense, stolen. No, it was pitched. So that was a learning lesson. You know, we went down the insurance
route. That's an expensive learning lesson.
Yeah. So, I mean, how about you, Doug? I know you work in, like, a large data center. Without getting too specific, what kind of physical security tricks do you employ?
Well, most of our data centers are off-site, so we generally have strict controls about who can get in. If there's any contractors or work for us, and they have to go through ourselves, we have to give them access to the data center. So it's an employee of the company has to action that request, and then they have to produce all the relevant details when you get to the data center. Once they're in there, they're only allowed to certain racks and cabinets, just usual kind of normal protocol in these big large data centers. If it's not in the work item, then they don't get to touch anything else. The various things you go through for identification is passports and stuff like that to get into these places. So it's compared to where I am now, compared to previous places, then it's a lot more secure than previous places. I mean, as you said earlier on, there's places where in remote sites, I remember when I came out of university, started my internship, and I phoned a couple of users to do something. I said, oh, by the way, can I get your password? And they went, yeah, sure, and just gave it over the phone.
Nice.
And it's one of those things as well. It's like physical security is great, but I think also a wee bit of it, and especially in the remote sites when there's no IT presence, where you've got guys who are a bit more sceptical.
Mm-hmm.
Sceptical? I don't know if that's a word, sceptic.
Yeah.
a bit more, you know, a bit wary of who's coming in and out. It'll be a bit of user education about whether or not people should be coming in and looking for IT, or whether or not who they should contact if they have people coming in and things like that. Because there's a number of times where if they get challenged a little bit, they'll just go, oh yeah, sure, no problem, it's through there. And I've heard of stories where smaller companies have had guys coming in and the server, all of a sudden server goes down, and they look back around and the server's no longer there. And as you guys have been talking about, there's no cameras, there's no real locks in the doors, it's just a cupboard in there. In the end office, you know.
Do you escort people through then? Have like someone with them at all times?
Yeah. Unless they're a trusted kind of support guy, which we work with regularly, then we kind of give them a bit of trust that way. But generally, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. I've been on both sides of that. When I was when I worked in supply chain software, I had everything from no controls to too many controls, like, you know, especially when we had like pharmaceutical clients and stuff like that. But
well, they have controls for a reason.
Yeah,
there's a good reason they're there.
I'll give you one example. There was a zone where we were testing part of our software, and it was a large pharmaceutical distributor. And then there was this little room in the back where they kept all the medical marijuana and that kind of stuff. And they had 2-to-1, meaning one worker, two people supervising, you know, for the test area of that.
Well, makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you just couldn't take any chances. And that was even just to go, I mean, that wasn't me, but my company who, like, the guys who dealt with, like, the physical equipment, it was a 2-to-1 supervision arrangement. So, you know, pretty much, and I think those two were actually supervising each other.
You actually, having a 2-to-1 supervision, whether it's a camera, two physical people, or two different pieces of security hardware, what you really need is, I mean, going down with that, if I have my camera, which I do, it sees the whole office where in the rack and stuff. And I know a couple of customers, if you want to do the loading docks and so forth, exactly what you said. But there's another very simple measure you can take. Nearly every piece of major hardware that you get has some sort of management tool. Like, for example, if you have HP hardware, it's HP SIM. If you have Dell, it's OpenManage. You have IBM, it's Director. All of these tools, you can even download them for free from the vendors, and use them to even monitor non-hardware, not even from their own. And what they'll do is they'll talk to the hardware and they'll alarm if something changes. Like, for example, somebody removes a hard drive.
Yep.
These alarms are going to go off. So having that type of tool in place as well gives you your secondary measure of, hey, somebody did something I didn't approve.
I think even there's intrusion detection. If you open the lid, you know, go in steal RAM or something, you could have that type of alert trigger. I think
if you steal RAM, your machine's going to go down. These systems are going to start screaming at you.
Yeah, true.
It depends if it's the. I mean, however, in certain modern hardware, you could literally change the RAM in and out, and it would still run because it has RAID RAM.
Right.
It's RAID. Yeah. Like, man, it's like incredible.
What about
RAM RAID, I should say?
I'm trying to think of, like, you know, I've seen these little extra locks and stuff that you can put, like, in, like, almost like a bar that goes in front of a rack so it can't open, or like a fence or a gate or something like that. Is that overkill, or is that just an additional hoop to put in physical security? Because I've seen those, like, I think I saw, it was an interview once of somebody in, like, a Google or an Amazon or something like that data center, and it was a, you know, a large, you know, name that we all know. I don't remember which one it was. Maybe it was eBay. And they had these, looks like a fence around each rack, and then each rack had its own door. But I'm wondering if you could take a piece of that to the small, you know, single rack or half rack that's in a remote location.
Well, you gotta remember, not all small businesses even have racks. They have baker's racks, or they have a shelf they put things on.
True.
They may have, I mean, I know one company that has 20, 30 different pieces of hardware, and there's really only three real servers in there. The other things are like,
yeah,
PCs.
What do you do in that situation? I mean, you don't have a rack.
That's when you start using the camera and you start using something like HP SIM, OpenManage, or Director to do what you do to monitor.
And the room, you know, lock the room as much as you can, or consolidate this stuff to a single place, or distribute it. That's a good question to you, Edward. Put it in one location that you can secure well, or put it in many locations that you can't secure so well, or many locations that you can secure well. Which way would you go?
Security by obscurity, in my mind, just doesn't work. However, distributing your assets around to various places that have locked doors is not a bad idea either. It depends on what type of assets you're going to be transferring. But if you have a lot of assets like that, you need to cool them. And it's probably cheaper from an ROI TCO perspective to cool one room than it is to cool an entire office.
Sure.
Now, during the winter,
You keep tracking them as well, Edwin, don't you? When they're all different rooms, and you need to know what rooms they're in and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Well, yeah, then you have a logistics issue of, I mean, when I worked for a big company, every year we went through the annual fire drill of find these assets. Well, they weren't in a central location, and no one knew where they were, so we had to go crawl under our desks or wherever we were and look for the asset numbers on the computers. Everybody that worked from home had to look for them. Everybody in the office had to look for them. And then they finally realized, oh, we got rid of those last year, or, oh, we found it. It was hiding behind this other monstrosity. So keeping one location from a business perspective, I think, is a lot less expensive.
Or at least a very small number. You know, I mean, it might make sense if you can equally protect two rooms pretty good, and especially if you have different physical access mechanisms, different keys. And then
it depends on if those security, if you need that type of security zones as well. I mean, a lot of these small businesses, a lot of their racks and computers are used for development. Developers need access to them, and they give them access. They grant them console access whenever they need them.
Right.
And if they have something that's a DMZ, they actually, in a lot of cases, host that by somebody else.
True.
I mean, there's a lot of cases that what's on-site, on-premise, is something they need to absolutely secure, but it's not running their day-to-day business. That's hosted somewhere. Most small businesses, that's what they're doing. They host it, and they let the physical security of the hosting provider take care of it.
What about you, Doug? I mean, I know you're in a little bit different space, but do you ever find yourself having developers or, you know, web services that you kind of use in, I don't want to say the cloud, but externally, consistently? Do you, you know, have those types of arrangements and with developers, or have you ever done that in the past?
No, not for physical access. I've dealt with virtualization for quite a while, so we haven't. I've been kind of away from that, but not for physical access. The only thing we have had in the past is a previous company where a couple of database servers, or one database server, wasn't responding, and a couple of database guys who were quite close to the server room were able to pop in and you know, physically reboot it. Mm-hmm. And from there, but we generally. Most companies I've been involved in, luckily, have always had some sort of access mechanism and process to follow to get into the data center. But some of the small clients I dealt with when I was consulting, as you've been talking about, they don't have anything like this. They don't have maybe just a cupboard at the end of the office, or a table in a room, and it's quite hard to then try and educate those people to understand. You know, you might need to secure that room, or you might need to lock it in a rack in a cupboard somewhere. It's because they don't see that threat as being anything. It's not like somebody coming in and or stealing a car or something. They don't see it as a physical something that will affect them in a way,
right.
Apart from maybe the IT guy. So thankfully, I've not had to deal with it very much. We haven't got people coming in, but. I think it's quite hard to even just try to educate some smaller type businesses to actually, you know, to realise that that's an asset and they should protect it as such, just as much as they should do the front door, you know?
Well, true, good point. And I think the one unit, if you had to pick one, it would be the room. Whatever room this stuff is in, you know, protect that room to the highest level with, you know, locks, cameras, and then maybe secondary mechanisms within those two categories, maybe a second lock or an additional camera that's controlled differently, or you know, one that is wireless and one that is not wireless, so that if the wire's cut, the wireless one may work, and or something like that. And those solutions don't necessarily have to be expensive. So
no, they don't, and I definitely would not rule out the software angle as well of monitoring the hardware.
Yeah.
For changes of, hey, someone ripped the drive out, someone took the box, shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, any type of disaster or security issue, any disaster can be a security issue, and any security issue could be a disaster. So the idea is to have all sorts of levels of monitoring. Monitor your physical environment. I mean, for example, one of the things I just recently put into my environment is to measure humidity.
Is that... Well, this, given the heat stretch we've had recently, even indoors, I'm sure we've seen the humidity increase quite a bit.
Absolutely, and I measure temperature and humidity right by the rack so that I can get alarmed if it gets too hot, and that's another issue that you need to do. And by the way, most people have UPSs.
Yep. I've got one too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you have an APC rack mount UPS, you can actually get plug-in boards that are humidity sensors and temperature sensors. These things are great. And they just plug right into the devices.
So,
and they're not that expensive.
I gotta ask. I got kind of ridiculed, and I need to ask these two guys here on the call. You guys are reasonable people. So, at home, I put little UPSs on everything, and I have a big UPS downstairs. When I say big, a 1500 rack mount for the Ricotron lab. Well, I even put little UPSs on like my alarm clock in my bedroom, because if the power's out in the middle of the night, I want to know about it. Is that overkill? What do you guys think?
Most alarm clocks I use have batteries in them.
I was about to say that exact same.
But they don't notify you that the power's out. They'll just carry on and keep time, but you could be sleeping along like a happy cat and not know that the power's out.
See, I don't have to worry about that in my particular house. I actually have a generator.
Me too.
So, you know, to me, UPSs are there to provide power as needed until my generator pops on, which is 15, 30 seconds.
Oh, it's auto-switching then?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. Now, that's cool. I have to wheel it out and hook it up.
But given the winters we have around here, this is a fairly smart thing to do. I mean, power can be out for 17 hours.
Yeah.
And I do that just to survive up here. But the main thing is that there's two things I like doing for a home or even a small office. And that is I like putting in a whole house surge suppressor. In a lot of ways, UPSs become surge suppressors,
mm-hmm.
right? If there's a lightning strike, the UPS will go and the equipment will last, which is the idea. Well, a whole house one means that if the electrical system gets hit, it blows at the inlet, not further down the line. The other thing I put in is a whole house surge suppressor for my cable and phone lines, so that these big capacitors, if they get the phone lines get hit, the capacitors will blow and the rest of the system will be fine. The reason why I do that is because my house got hit by lightning one time and melted all my phone lines.
Wow.
And it took me 3 days to find the exact problem. It was I had multiple lines running all around, and it took me several days to find where the problem was, and then I had to fix it by rerouting a good 100 feet of cable, rerunning.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So those are two measures I make that are security, but putting UPS on my alarm clock, if you need that level of notification, sure, go for it. If I'm in a business and I have my alarm, my UPS goes out, I want to know because I may have to run over there and get that. So I want my UPS to call me in some way.
Sure.
It flips on there. I need some sort of monitoring software that's probably part of the UPS or something that does that, voltage checks and so forth, to actually mail me or send an alarm or a page to my phone. That's all part of doing business. You have to do that.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, so I guess I'm still a little bit on the ridiculous side with my alarm clock on the UPS.
You know what? If the power goes out, it's not something I'm going to wake up anyways in my house because I have fans running and AC running. You know, that's all going to turn off and it's going to get really hot really quickly in the summer. I'll wake up in no time.
I will sleep through anything. That's the problem. That's why I put it on there, because I need to. But like a UPS beep, that'll get me up like that, because it's a noise.
Yeah, no,
I recognize.
I don't think that's overkill if you need it.
Well,
you have to wake up to go plug in your generator. I mean, that's something that's kind of important.
Right. Well, this is a discussion we've had at home. I'm just trying to get some reasonable people's opinions here. I'll leave it at that.
Well, if you don't want that generator running in the middle of the night or running, hey, then don't do it.
No, I don't mind the generator running. In fact, it's not that loud. Mine's gas. I don't know if yours is natural gas.
Mine's propane, actually.
Even better. Mine's gasoline, which, I mean, it's capable of running the whole house except the air conditioner and the dryer, which is fine with that for me.
Well, we chose really carefully. It's like keep the refrigerator running because we don't want our food to spoil. You know, some medium of light so we can move around in the night. things like that. You got to be really careful what you plug into these things. But in your case, when the power goes out and it's out for an extended period of time, you want to get woken up so that you can turn on your generator.
Yep, yep.
You don't have an auto-switching one, so that makes sense. Use whatever you need to do.
Okay, cool. That helps. Well, let's wrap it up, guys. I hope that everybody walks away with some kind of specific ideas. I'm really just trying to give ideas on physical security. I mean, we all focus a lot on non-physical security, so system and network and application configuration security or whatever the categories are. And if you have it, by the way, I've been pimping his book. Edward's got a number of good books. Edward, can you give us an inventory of some of your good books that are out right now?
There's VMware vSphere and Virtual Infrastructure Security, Securing the Virtual Environment. That's available on Amazon. There's a second edition of my first virtualization book called VMware ESX and ESXi in the Virtual Environment, Planning Your Virtual Deployments. That's a second edition of my previous book. The both of those together give you a kind of an idea of how to plan out your in architecture environments for ESX and ESXi and how to pull security in from the very beginning when you do these architectures.
And cheap plug for Veeam, if you attend the Veeam featured webinars, Edward's ESX and ESXi in the Enterprise book is available as an option. All the featured webinars, we hand out 10 books, so 10 winners can get their choice of books, of which one of Edward's books is in there. And we can have that to you zippity-split like a Kindle book really quick. And I love gifting the Kindle books. It's awesome. It's just it's a pretty straightforward way to go. I've been reading the Kindle books, and I really like them. So definitely check that out. And, Doug, any final comments?
No, I've read one of Edward's books. It's really, really good. So I haven't got to the second one yet, so looking forward to that.
Yeah, definitely. He's got good books. That's why he's on my list. Anyways, hey, if you guys have any questions on the podcast, just send an email to podcast@veeam.com. I'm Rick Vanover on Twitter, @RickVanover, and Doug is on Twitter, @Douglas_Carson. And Edward, if you want to take a chance to pimp your blog, pimp your Twitter.
I'm @TexIWill on Twitter. I also have a virtualization security podcast. The one that's coming up this week is going to have MITRE joining us. And we're going to be going over their new security framework, risk framework, I should say, as it applies to clouds. And I have two blogs, actually. One's virtualizationpractice.com. It's my analyst blog. And I have kind of a daily upgrade blog that I've been maintaining at www.aspararch.com.
That's right. It's good stuff. I encourage you to check it out.